This is the Better Reading Podcast platform with stories behind the story, Jane's Be Better podcast, My Book Chat with Caroline Overington, and more. Looking for a particular podcast? Remember, you can always skip to it.
Welcome to the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story, brought to you by Belinda Audio. Listen to Belinda audiobooks anywhere, everywhere.
Hi, this is Cheryl Arkell from the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story. We talk to authors about how they came to tell us their story. Thomas Mayer, welcome to Better Reading.
Thank you, Cheryl. Happy to be here.
Oh, gosh, I'm so excited about this conversation. Thomas is up in Darwin and I'm here in freezing cold Sydney this morning, so I'm feeling very envious. I'm going to introduce you. Thomas is a Torres Strait Islander born on Larrakia country in Darwin. He worked as a union official for the Maritime Union of Australia before he became a key signatory and a campaigner for the Uluru Statement from the Heart. He travelled around Australia campaigning to enshrine a First Nations voice in the Constitution. Okay, so that gives me goosebumps always. I've read this a couple of times this morning and it really does. It does come from the heart, and I want to talk to you about that at length, actually. More recently, he wrote and edited Dear Son. It is an absolute gorgeous anthology. That's not in my notes, I'm just saying that. And it really is beautiful, an anthology written by First Nations men about life, masculinity, culture and racism. And do you know what? I've got to say, every Australian male should read this book.
Beautiful.
So, Thomas, firstly, I want to start. Talk to me about what the Uluru Statement from the Heart is. Tell us about that.
Well, the Uluru Statement from the Heart has a long history. It has a history that goes before colonisation began, really, because it is the culmination of of so many lessons from the history of our struggle. And the Uluru Statement begins, as we always should when we talk about it, in that First Nations people had a very happy, abundant and peaceful life here before Captain Cook came and told lies about Terra Nullius, saying that these lands were vacant and that we didn't exist. And so, even experts support that in that how these languages have developed, so many hundreds of languages on one continent so close to each other. We weren't a conquering people. We knew what land we belonged to, and we were masters of dispute resolution and had advanced societies. The Uluru Statement begins there, but then it takes us through this long history of struggle and the lessons that we've learnt and the reality of what it is today, and very importantly, how we can take action for the solutions. The statement came from, more contemporarily, there were 13 regional dialogues that covered the entire continent and adjacent islands. It was Indigenous expert-led and designed. People like Arnie Pat Anderson and Professor Megan Davis, who is an expert in public law. So there was a very careful formula applied to participants to ensure a range of perspectives, because you can never have every Indigenous person in the country at one set of meetings. And we had a lot of passionate debate and discussion. Each of those 13 dialogues were 3 days. And then delegates were elected to go to the heart of the country at Uluru, which is where the Uluru Statement words came together and gifted to the Australian people, really.
Mm. So in a practical sense, how does it affect life day to day for Indigenous people or Aboriginal people?
Well, it gives us hope, I think, day to day at the moment, because it's a very rare opportunity for First Nations people in this country to come together in a proper Indigenous-led and well-formulated way to reach a consensus on what we want. You see, there is no structure behind Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander advocacy at that level right now on a national basis on purely political and visionary matters. So when we came together at Uluru, that was a great opportunity, and that we reached a consensus the way that we did. You know, there was around 270 of us at Uluru, as usual in politics, when there's, you know, such a large group of people, some didn't agree and walked out. There was around 20 on the second day, but 250 remained and endorsed it with standing acclamation. I saw people that had been in passionate debate against each other, embracing each other with tears of joy and hope, you know, like it just came together on that final day at Uluru. And it's a political feat that this country should celebrate, let alone go out and do as it proposes.
And also, too, I think sometimes when you're in negotiations like that, it's not 100% all the way. You take, I think, the approach is in terms of negotiation is you take bit by bit. You take this lot and then, you know, see what happens with the next lot and see what happens rather than totally, no, I'm not doing this.
Yeah, I love that you say that, Cheryl. It's the way I describe what you're saying is that the nature of consensus is that not everybody gets everything that
That's
they want.
Right. Yeah.
It's the hard work and it's the compromise amongst the people that are to be united. And that's what came together at Uluru.
Yeah.
And it doesn't propose anything that's out of this world, that's different from the way our political system, even the Western political system, works right now. It is a gift. It simply proposes that the constitution that excluded us in 1901 as a people with a special place in this country is amended to recognise that we exist. To recognise at first,
kind of outrageous that it does,
and that we have a voice, that we have a say on the matters that affect us. And when I say have a say, a lot of Australians are unaware. In our constitution, there is a provision called Section 5126. It's the race power that provides the federal parliament with the power to make special laws about a race of people. That's in our constitution now. And it has only been used to make special laws about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And the High Court found in a case called the Hindmarsh case that power could be used to make laws to our detriment, not only to our benefit. And so, you know, to have a voice on how they use that power is a very simple and reasonable ask. It's a fair go, really.
Absolutely. I want to go back, Thomas, to how you became the remarkable person you are today. You know, how you've an extraordinary career. Tell me about growing up, because with this podcast, it's the stories behind the story. So how you came to tell us your story. So I want to go right back to when you were little, where you grew up and how it is that you think, what got you to here?
Well, I grew up in Darwin. On Larrakia country, always a very, very quiet kid. And, you know, that's not an exaggeration. It was people at footy or, you know, at work, even as a young adult would say, you know, ask if I have a voice at all. They thought I was mute. I was so quiet. But, you know, I played rugby league growing up. That was my childhood, really. Loved going fishing.
I want to talk about your childhood a little bit more. Were you surrounded by your own people? Were you at a school where, and the reason why I'm asking you that is I'm Lebanese Australian and I grew up in Glebe, which is predominantly white, and I suffered a lot of racism as a child in primary school. People laughed at my lunch, people laughed at my cardigan, people laughed at my, you know, and I'm just wondering, did you have any of those experiences?
Yeah, I totally understand. I had those experiences. At school, I was one of the only Torres Strait Islanders and Indigenous people in primary school days. And, those sorts of differences, as children do, are pointed out and mocked. Mm-hmm. But in my outside of school, in sport and in, you know, amongst family, I was amongst my own. And Darwin's that sort of place where, you know, like, for example, our rugby team, we were almost all Indigenous, you know, so.
Do you know, I've been up there a few times and only recently, like in the last 10 years, I had a friend up there and I was blown away at how diverse it was.
It's very diverse.
It's different to the rest.
You see, it's the Torres Strait itself, you know, because I've got my great-great-grandfathers were Malay and Filipino that went to the Torres Strait in the pearling days and, you know, intermarried. And so Darwin is another pearling frontier in Broome. So, you know, we all have that great mix of ethnicities and Asian influence. Yeah. Mm.
So for me, my experience, and I want to know if this for you happened, for the large part of my early days primary school, all I wanted to be is I just wanted to be white, right? I wished every morning I wished I had blonde hair, right? and I had dark curly hair that was all over the place, you know. And every time I looked around me, I wanted to be somebody who I wasn't. I really didn't want people. I avoided speaking Arabic at all costs. You know, I was trying to be Australian. And then I think it happened in mid high school. I just thought, what am I doing? I need to embrace this because it's a gift. And did you have that? Did that happen to you?
Yeah, I'm getting goosebumps now. I didn't have that. To think about it, I wonder why, actually, because I've never really thought about that. But I was proud of Torres Strait Islander culture. I loved that we ate turtle and dugong and our traditional foods, because there's plenty on the reefs here and around Darwin. And I did island dancing, you know, when I was young, for weddings and things like that. And I think as far as role models go, I looked up, basketball players, black basketball players and Indigenous rugby league players. So, yeah, I didn't have that. Yeah. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Well, good. Well, you're a stronger person than I was. Okay. Now tell me then. So how then did you become to be a union official? Because it seems to me you are quietly spoken, and I can see that just from our conversation today via Zoom. You've got that beautiful quietness about you. But when I read your biography, there's a strongness there as well. I mean, you're not going to just sit around and watch things happening around you. You're going to participate and you're going to be a leader.
Yeah, I just can't stand injustice, and that's always what has drawn out my voice, I think. You know, and in the book, Dear Son, I do talk a bit about how my, father was towards me, quite harsh, but loving at the same time. That in a lot of ways it was the typical, man of that generation. And really I found my voice both on the footy field, but that was only on the field sort of thing, and then the union. And I'm still an official of the MUA. I'm the National Indigenous Officer. And the union just had so much influence on me about how to speak up and how to speak and how to organise power for those that are, that are most vulnerable and struggling. So, and in a lot of ways to do that for more than, so to build power for more than your own benefit, wages and conditions on the wharf, but actually to use that power to help others, like my own people, Indigenous people. There's lots of examples of unions in this country, my union, Maritime Union, helping in the Gurindji Wayfield walk-off, for example, the Pilbara strike, the Noongar dispute. The list just goes on, and it's an important part of why Australia is the way it is today, the things that we enjoy and take for granted, I mean.
And so talk to me about where the love of reading and writing came. I think I read somewhere that in primary school a teacher said to you, was it primary school or high school? I'm not sure. A teacher said to you that I think you should be a writer.
Yeah, it was in high school. It was year 11, actually. Miss Arthur was her name. Don't know where she is now. I've tried to have a look, but I'd love to say hello. But I never expected to be a writer even then, although I remember something clicking. We had a test and we had to do descriptive writing, and, there was a set amount of time to write a descriptive. And it just sort of clicked, okay, I just write some big fancy words am I allowed to say a small swear word here?
Yeah, absolutely.
I thought to myself, I'll just talk shit on paper. And and so I did that and I got an A, and I thought, oh, okay, this is how it works. And then I ended up getting an A, that year, and that's, when the teacher said I should be a writer one day. But then I think I learned how to write and enjoyed it somewhat then as a union delegate and an official, because you tend to write a bit of persuasive stuff, right? Trying to, give them the boss a spray, or, trying to round up the workers and everything. And so I think that helped, along with writing for the lawyers, in putting things in chronological form, enterprise agreements were my Bible, so I read all that, and I think that helped as well.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
What about reading fiction? Were you a big reader?
I remember I picked up a book for the first time. I decided I'm going to read again. And I think it was in my very early 20s. I hadn't read a lot, you know, since I was a kid. And I went to a secondhand bookshop in Darwin Mall. And I sort of randomly picked this book, and it was, I think it was Tomo and Hawk is the middle book in Bryce Courtenay's Potato Factory. And so I read that, and I really enjoyed it and realised it was a middle of three, so I went and got the rest. And so since then I've loved reading, and I read as much fiction as I can. Of course, in different parts of your life you read non-fiction. You know, like when I wrote my first book, I read a lot of non-fiction. To research, yeah.
I want to go back to that, but I just want to tell you a funny story. So in my career, right, you know, when I go out to dinners, back in the day when we could go out because we're in lockdown, but, you know, when I was socialising, and this is so typical, and this is saying that you're typical, right, Thomas, because when I sit next to somebody at a dinner, if it's a female and they ask me what I do and I say, you know, I work with books and blah, 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 they'll ask me, you know, what to recommend, what book will I read next, blah, blah, blah. So that's the typical female response that I get. If I sit next to a male, right, the typical response that I get, oh, yeah, it's usually a confession, and it's usually I haven't read a book since I was 17 or I haven't read a book since I was 20, you know, and that is really quite common for me. I can absolutely pick what they're going to say to me.
Yeah.
Not typical of that.
Yeah, that's what I say to my son, in Dear Son, in my letter to him. You need to read, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
So talk to me about reading nonfiction and researching, because I recorded a podcast recently with Stan Grant and read his book. And, you know, of course, I've got a crush on him. Don't tell him, right? And two, I love the book.
Yeah. About reading fiction.
Reading nonfiction.
Oh, reading nonfiction.
And doing research for your book.
Oh, I really enjoyed that too, you know. At least a couple of years, I didn't read a fiction because I was getting stuck into nonfiction because I just wanted to learn, you know. And, you know, I think that's the great – I mean, it's not that you don't learn from fiction, but – there's so much to learn from people that are sharing things in non-fiction books. You could just read forever and still, you know, have things to learn. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, continuously. Okay, so what brought you to writing this book? It's an anthology. So what did you write your story first and think, oh, this might be interesting, I might collect a couple of others? Tell me how the book came about.
Yeah, so I was at the Perth Writers Festival with Tara June Winch, who...
Oh.
Miles Franklin.
Can I tell you, that's another crush I have. She's divine. I just love her. So I've recorded a podcast with her twice in person, and I just adored her.
Yeah, she's very thoughtful, you know.
Gentle soul.
Yeah. And so she was like that with me. It was my first ever, it was my first ever writer's festival. And because, you know, I had two books out, I think, by then. The Finding the Heart of the Nation and the children's book Finding Our Heart. And she and I were talking, and then later on at the drinks we talked again, and she said, Thomas, you'd be a good person to write a book about fatherhood, because I've got five kids, and obviously we talked about family and children and things, and And I thought, I think I said, oh, I don't know about that, you know, because, you know, I'm thinking about my flaws and, you know, all these sorts of things. But I thought it would be a great idea for someone to do. I said, I'll think about it. So that's how the idea came about. What inspired me to actually do it was reading James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time. A good friend, Teela Reid, lent me the book. And I was inspired by the letter to his nephew, and it sort of clicked. This is how, you know, I could write a book about fatherhood, letters to sons, and that's how it came about.
Mm. And so did you write your letter first before you invited other people to write?
Yeah, so the very first thing I did was sit down and start to write a letter to my son, and it was extremely hard, partly I think because, or maybe it's any writing, but how do I begin this? You know, how do I start this conversation on paper with my son? But once I found the opening lines, which is about, which begins basically about a time where he was about nine and I did not hold his hand in the shopping centre when he wanted to, because I said, you know, you're getting a bit old now. And, you know, just how wrong that was. And so that's how I opened the letter. And once I did that, you know, it sort of opened the floodgates and away I went.
How do you think parenthood has changed you?
I think the first thing that I realised about being a father, how it changed me, was I was a crane driver on the wharfs. And, you know, you're up pretty high, you know, in these big container cranes and everything. And I had no fear until my first child was born. And I remember noticing not long after that I was afraid of every bump and you know, and thing. And so that was one of the things, I think, you know, you shift from, you know, wanting to survive and provide for your children, I think was the first sort of thing that kicked in for me. And that's one of the ways I noticed. But, yeah, I mean, and then the biggest next change is something that I talk about in the book, where I realised there is no excuse about, you know, gender roles and how you love your children and the cuddles that you provide and all that sort of stuff. You know, those sort of wrong lessons that I learnt, you know, from the way our culture is far too often.
Mm. Do you know, and I don't know if there's a parallel here, and you can correct me if there isn't, but my parents were immigrants, right, and they came out to Australia in the late 50s to provide their kids a better life. And those kids, we did get a better life. Because of their sacrifice, we got a better life. Do you think that's the same for your children? Do you see that happening in generations of First Nations people?
Yeah, certainly. I think... And one of the reasons my father was harsh, I think, was because he was just surviving, had just come out of the, you know, the Protection Act and complete control by the state. Mm-hmm. Myself, you know, grew up, you know, with little, you know, because they were, you know, mum and dad didn't have a lot, one income family. And now my children, you know, have so much more than I did and way more than my father did growing up. And, yeah, that's got to continue to improve, I think, for our children, and that's one of the reasons I wrote this book. I think the next way we can improve, as men certainly, is to improve how we treat women and, you know, the way we behave. And
I often think there's a focus on First Nations people and the way that men treat women. But do you know, if you look at it, I don't know if you've been read the Jess Hill book on domestic violence.
Yeah.
Ah, there you go. It's right behind you. And domestic violence is not unique to First Nations people. It is insidious, you know, and people often, I hear people say things like that and I think, look around you, people. I mean, one of the most startling things I got from that book was that the family was one of the most dangerous places for women.
Oh. Yeah, and I should clarify, you know, when I was talking about men's behaviour, I was talking in general. And I think that's important for listeners to hear. And it's one of the inspirations for Dear Son, that You know, that when I was in school, I was taught that my forefathers were savages and unintelligent. Sitting next to non-Indigenous kids, they were taught that their, you know, forefathers were scientists and explorers, our saviours. And then, you know, like in 2007, as a young man, and I cover this in my introduction, as a young man, the Northern Territory intervention, where, you know, precisely what you were talking about, Cheryl, basically a prime minister announces to the country that there needs to be extreme measures because Aboriginal men are terrible pedophiles and all these things uniquely. It was just disgusting. And, you know, talking to some of the people that have contributed to this book, Johnny Little in particular, who lives in Alice Springs, he said in those times it was really hard because you could just be standing at the shop and either himself or a young Indigenous man holding his kid, he could see the eyes, you know, looking at them suspiciously in that time when you know, Prime Minister John Howard was saying and all these awful things about Aboriginal men. You know, these are the stereotypes that I really hope this book breaks through. It's a problem. It's a male problem. It is a problem that men in general have. It is in my communities. It's in all communities, and it's got to stop.
Absolutely. I'm not going to get political on you because I try to curb that. But can I just say, I have been saying for years and years, John Howard introduced hatred in this country.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Totally agree with you.
Yeah. Not just against, you know, First Nations people, not just everything. Everything. He used his political power to stay in power through hatred.
And yeah. That toxicity continues through our politics today. It's a real...
It's terrible.
Yeah.
So tell me how you got your selection of authors. Was that something you did, or did you pitch the idea to a publisher? How did that come about?
No, I did it. I just tried to think of people that I thought would have a powerful story. That's how I did it. I wanted to cover a bit of the country, you know. I wasn't too focused on that, but I did want people from, you know, the different places around the country. And once I had written my first draft, I provided that to the people that I invited with a bit of a spiel about, you know, what the book would try to do. And away we went. Yeah, most people accepted. A few didn't, but it's a great collection of contributors. You've read the letters, have you?
Yeah, I have. I haven't finished, but of course, I was very drawn to it because of your story, but also, you know, my crush Stan Grant's in it.
So. Oh, he's got a beautiful letter, doesn't he?
He's a gentle storyteller. Yeah, he is. Okay, so. I can hear some activity in the background. I can hear kids.
Do you mean
hear dogs? No. I'm talking about that. I want to know how you balance everything. How you balance writing, working, family of five. You know, dogs in the background. I mean, I often ask authors that story. I mean, it's a juggle, right? Or do you not sleep much?
I love writing. I write at night and, you know, I've got my union job through the day.
Yeah.
It gives me space to do these things, you know, because, you know, ultimately this is part of, you know, progressing Aboriginal rights, you know, First Nations rights. So, but, yeah, my routine basically is I write best after a coffee, you know, early in the morning and then, you know, especially if I have a deadline, I get stuck into it at night and work through the night. Yeah.
There you go. Well, keep writing because I want to keep reading. You've got a beautiful voice and thank you so much for this collection. It really is gorgeous. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Cheryl. It's been a pleasure.
If you'd like more information about Better Reading, follow us on Facebook or visit betterreading.com.au.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by Belinda Audio. Belinda audiobooks are available on CD and MP3 from online booksellers and bookshops everywhere, or you can download from Audible, Google Play or the iBook Store. We've also created our own app called BorrowBox that's available from both the App Store and Google Play. All you need to do to get it working is to download the app, Join your local public library and you'll gain access to the world's best collection of ebooks and e-audiobooks available for you to loan on your phone or your personal device. Belinda, we're here to enable you to escape, imagine, grow, and be inspired through the power of storytelling. Belinda Audiobooks. Anywhere, everywhere.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
If you enjoyed this podcast, leave us a review and check out the other podcasts on the Better Reading Network.